So for the, I'm going to be talking about the first precept, okay? And some of my talk, in case, for those of you who like references, if you want to sort of go on and do a bit more further reading, some of it is taken from the Ten Pillars, which we've already referred to, and other parts of it are from Living with Kindness. Alternatively, you could just practice it. So the first precept, so it's the principle of abstention from killing beings or love. So what we say when we recite the refuges and precepts is, a quick reminder, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body, which means to act kindly towards other beings, roughly speaking. And the negative version is, I undertake to abstain from taking life, meaning roughly to avoid causing harm to other beings. So love or loving kindness is a, if not, I think, the fundamental Buddhist virtue. It underpins and flows through the other precepts, a little bit like mindfulness, similarly, is the building block for all the other precepts. So they're not kind of a linear thing. I mean, the programme this week, we necessarily are working in human time, so we're working through a precept today. But of course, they interlock with each other. So loving kindness is described as excellent or sublime, since it's the right or skillful way of behaving towards other living beings. So in its ideal form, it's boundless, and it's not exclusive, and it's impartial. And it embraces all sentient beings, regardless of whether they're useful or pleasing to us. So in practicing the first precept, we're recognising actively our fundamental connection to every other sentient being. So as the Buddha says, identifying ourselves with others, we can never slay or cause to slay. Now, an obvious interpretation of the first precept is not to kill other people or other sentient beings. Now, probably don't need to explain why that's unskillful, but wishing to be thorough, I will. So, this is unskillful because it deprives them of the precious gift of life. It causes them suffering and is the enactment of a mind state rooted in the root poisons of greed, hatred and delusion. So the Dhammapada says, all living beings are terrified of punishment. All fear death. Putting oneself in the place of others, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. And all living beings are terrified of punishment. All love life. Putting oneself in the place of others, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. So I think this kind of initial notion of not killing other beings, in some ways it can feel a bit remote. You think, well, of course I wouldn't kill another being, or of course I wouldn't kill another person. But actually, in everyday life, all the time, we witness death, in various contexts. And I think in many ways we can envisage and even sanction the killing of animals and, by default, often other people in other parts of the world. But of course, people are much more than a mere body, okay? And I think reflecting more on the first precept reveals that it means much more than just abstention from killing or causing the death, the physical death of another being. It's got much more far-reaching implications in terms of the work we do, what we eat, what we wear, how we love, how we travel, how we spend our time. So it's very far-reaching. And all of these things that we do in the world can be driven by the root poisons of greed, hatred and delusion, and often are. So metta tackles these root poisons, and I think these root poisons are essentially what keeps our ego show on the road. And it maintains us, these root poisons maintain us in states in which it's much easier to act unskillfully. So there's a saying by a Zen teacher whose name I'm sorry I haven't recorded. He says that the powerful irony in relation to the first precept is that the strongest way of following the first precept is by metaphorically killing the self. So we're not killing other people or other beings, we're killing ourselves, metaphorically, of course. So this first precept addresses our feelings, our perceptions, our volitions, and it transforms our consciousness, which in turn transforms our bodily actions and speech. And again, as the Dhammapada says, and you'll know this quotation, I'm sure, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. So our mental, internal, spiritual states fundamentally matter, and they determine the status of our external actions. So I'm going to start with a quotation from... That was a preamble, by the way. I was going to start with a quotation from Shelley that Bhante uses in his discussion of the first precept in the Ten Pillars. So I'll then focus in on some of the words from the quotation. And then I'm going to move on to look at how we can practice the first precept and mention some of its pitfalls. So the quotation from Shelley... He says, the great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful, which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A person to be greatly good must imagine intensely and comprehensively. They must put themselves in the place of another and of many others. The pains and the pleasures of their species must become their own. I've obviously made it a gender-neutral quotation there. So acting skillfully here involves a love that entails going out of our own nature. And I think what he means here by own nature, I don't think he's referring to Buddha nature. I think he's really referring to our own nature as self-interest, our own sphere of concern. So we're endeavouring to move out of that sphere of self-concern and towards an identification with what is not us. So it's a journey that shifts us out of our self-concern so that the other's concerns seem as vital and as important as our own. So I think this involves a sort of sustained act of empathic imagination, since we try to imagine more deeply. And I think in this context, identification, I think, is a terribly slippery word. So I'm going to define my terms. So I think in this context, identification means that we become aware that just like us, that other being, person or animal, seeks contentment and freedom from pain. That they experience pleasures and pains like myself. So Shantideva says in the Bodhicaryavatara, all have the same sorrows, the same joys as I. I must destroy the pain of another as though it were my own, because it is a pain. I must show kindness to others, for they're creatures, as I am myself. So we may not have had the same experience, or we may not be in the same situation as that other being. We may not even know much about their life or their situation. I think it's helpful here to think about metta as a volition. So metta is a volition, it's an act of willing loving kindness to all beings. because I suppose in my experience, if we engage with metta as a feeling, it's just way too unreliable. I don't know about you, but my feelings, you know, whoosh about all through the day. And I think if I was going to cultivate metta as a feeling to some of you, you wouldn't be very happy about it, because it just wouldn't be very much to offer you. So I think I'd like to offer you my metta as a volition, okay? So I'm going to be setting my intention, okay? So metta's, I think, also not, it's not based on knowledge or us feeling that we're the same as that other person or we like that other person. So it's rooted then in this volition, and it's rooted in wisdom and an insight into the workings of samsara as conditioned existence. So it's not a lovely quote, this is from one of my KMs, Dharmotra, it's not what she calls egotism à deux. Okay. So it really is moving out of our own self nature into the world. And something that I've been reflecting on quite a bit in terms of my relationships with others is that it seems to me, and I don't know, this is maybe something that you can have a think about if it's of interest to you, is that our relationships with others are not really about a sort of a knowledge, they're not a kind of knowledge-based thing or a practice of knowledge, but they're really a practice of insight. So I think our relationships are a practice of insight. Yeah. So I think love and loving in this sense is an unconditional affirmation of another being. So it's not a codependent transaction, as I think is sometimes the case in erotic love or love between family members or friends. We're very familiar, I think, with that notion of attachment and how Velcro-like, how sticky it can be when attachment finds its way into our relationships. So that codependent love says, if you do this for me, I'll do that for you. Or, rather worse, it might even say, you must do that for me, or I'll do that to you in retaliation. So it can be quite fraught, I think, with all these kind of hidden and often unstated sort of transactional rules to the ways and conditions in which we love. So I think that kind of love is a kind of needy kind of love, isn't it? It feels to me quite codependent and transactional, and also from a dharmic perspective, it's really dualistic. Yeah. So it can shore up this ego identity, it can shore up love as a role. I'm your partner, you're my partner, okay? I'm your mother. And these roles... No, I'm not your mother. Sorry, don't need to go into the mother thing. And these roles, I think, they maintain us and other people in place, don't they? And because they maintain us and the other person in place, they're fixing strategies. And in a way, I think they're trying to sort of... they're kind of safety strategies, and they're trying to kind of second guess the way the person would behave in a year's time, you know, or something like that. And that, of course, completely frustrates not only our growth and development, but it also frustrates the other person's growth and development. So there's no kind of going out of our own nature. In fact, there's a consolidation of our own nature. So another quotation, this time from Oscar Wilde, signals this mindset. And it's taken from The Ballad of Reading Gaol, which Wilde wrote in France, in exile from the UK, after he'd been released from prison. And the poem is about a fellow prisoner who was in jail at the time with Wilde, who was executed in jail for strangling his wife. I'm not going to read you the whole poem because it's very long, so I'm just going to read you a short extract. Yet each man kills the thing he loves. By each let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Some kill their love when they're young, and some when they're old. Some strangle with the hands of lust, some with the hands of gold. The kindest use a knife, because the dead so soon grow cold. Some love too little, some too long. Some sell, and others buy. Some do the deed with many tears, and some without a sigh. For each man kills the thing he loves, yet each man does not die. So I think Wilde here is expressing this paradox of egotistical love, that we may think that we love, and yet in such instances where our relationships are driven by a neediness and a codependence, we're most likely to be operating in what Bante has called the power mode rather than the love mode. So to operate in the power mode means to relate to others in terms of violence, either explicitly by the use of physical or psychological force to get what one wants from them, or by much more subtle means and forms of violence against another person, such as coercion or taking the not given. And here we've obviously got an overlap with the second precept. So it involves negating their being in some way for our own benefit. And thinking forward this morning, in the groups, if you wanted to sort of circle around a particular question in the groups, what you could have a think about is thinking about your relationships in your life at the moment and thinking about those in terms of love and power modes, if that's of interest to you. You might find other things that are of interest to you, but possible one. So the love mode, by contrast, affirms another's being, and it helps to foster positive conditions for them to find their own way. So it respects their freedom. So we witness the other person, but we don't try to fix them or get something from them. So it's really more in terms of what can I give rather than what can I get. Yet, of course, acting from the love mode is a very high ideal, and it might not always be possible. So sometimes in life it might be necessary to act against another's seeming well-being. And I think it can be quite difficult to know what somebody else's well-being is, as I'll talk about a bit later. But sometimes it might be really obviously necessary to act against their initial well-being to avoid a greater harm. So the example that's often used is a mother who violently drags her child out of the road to stop her child getting run over. And that's a pretty straightforward example, I think. I guess most of us would do that, hopefully all. And in such cases, I think the power mode needs to be subordinated to the love mode wherever possible. So what we're trying to do as much as possible is operate in the love mode. And assuming that we're also practicing mindfulness and we're trying to practice the precepts, I think the situation will tell us what to do. Okay, assuming we're practicing. If we're not, then it's all a bit random, but if we're practicing, trying to practice the precepts, I think it'll become obvious to us in the situation what is needed. So how do we practice the first precept more deeply? Well, I think firstly it's good to have some insight into ourselves and our habitual behaviours or samskaras. So how our mind works, I think Maitre Siddhi used a very useful phrase, our mental topography. Love that. So how our mind works and what we keep on doing. So how do we try to keep our own ego show on the road? And I think as we come into gentle relationship with our own mind, we begin slowly to become aware of the parts of ourselves that are a bit zoned out, a bit unintegrated. And I think we realise, or I certainly realise, trying to realise, where we keep aspects of our life vague to ourselves, as well as to others. And I think that vagueness allows us to keep doing what we habitually do. And I think we also might realise that we're actually quite a mystery to ourselves. And that sometimes we don't understand why we do what we do, and we keep on doing them. And that's kind of before we get to other people, as it were. So this investigation into our mental life, the term is Dharma Vichaya, needs to be done with self-metta. So I think it's not really possible to act with metta in a sustained way towards others if we don't practice metta towards ourselves. I think our reactions towards others are often simply our own relationship to ourselves, just writ large. So without self-metta, our metta towards others, I think, tends to be based in quite an alienated state, which can easily tip into all sorts of, I think, quite unhelpful behaviours like martyrdom, the sort of Joan of Arc syndrome. It can tip into do-gooding, trying to fix other people, which I have been very guilty of myself in the past and trying not to do anymore. I think it can also tip into a sort of self-abuse, a sort of quite sort of harmful relationship with ourselves, where, well, yes, I'll show metta to lots of other people, but I won't show it to myself. Okay. And I think without this self-metta, our ego show continues to stay very much on the road. And I think sometimes it can be less obvious to ourselves how sort of negative pride or a sort of a lack of care towards ourselves is also a form of egotism, actually, because it sort of holds ourselves up as somebody particularly unworthy of metta, whereas, of course, we're all worthy of metta. So getting a sort of strong self-metta practice together can really ground us in positive emotions such as self-respect and also self-forgiveness. And I think forgiving ourselves for our own inevitable humanity, that we are all flawed beings, and that's okay, sets us on the path to forgive other people too. And that's why, you know, if it's something that you'd like to do on this retreat, confession practice can be really helpful for that. So I think then we can turn more wholesomely towards other people and really see that they suffer the pains and pleasures as we do, even if they're not our sort of person. I think too often we can set up all sorts of unacknowledged expectations and conditions to engage with people on our own terms. And I'm often kind of struck how in society, in our kind of organisation of intimacy, in society at large, we construct these hierarchies of intimacy. So we have hierarchies of intimacy and care in society at large. And I think that's very much what the spiritual community is trying to challenge, really. It's a radical project that we're involved in here. And I think these hierarchies of intimacy tend to sort of construct our partners and our families somewhere near the top, and then maybe our friends, or depending on what your situation looks like. I personally only have one family member left now, so my hierarchy of intimacy, which I'm trying to challenge, looks like my partner and my mother and then my friends, okay, some of whom are in the spiritual community. But it's something that concerns me, actually, in terms of how I construct that. And then after that kind of hierarchy of intimacy, this kind of pyramid, there's a sort of sea of other beings who sometimes don't always merit our attention, or maybe not in a very sustained kind of way. So a kind of question, I think, for me, ongoingly, is where do I draw the line? You know, it's that question I sort of raised last night. It's about, well, who do I turn to? And what is the sphere of my concern? I'm not going to answer that question. It's one of those pesky rhetorical questions. And at some level, you might say, this is perfectly realistic. We have hierarchies of intimacy because that's perfectly realistic, because you can't love everybody. Okay, you can't help everybody and you can't care for everybody, so that's okay. Okay, I have a short life, I have a limited life, that's why I've got my hierarchy of intimacy, thank you. But my experience, and I would suggest this to you, is that once we kind of manage to get our sort of ego show a little bit out of the way, or my experience anyway, and it may or may not be yours, is that I find myself having more energy. Okay, I find myself having more energy, and more energy is liberated, and then I actually do find I can engage more with other people. And I think a lesson that I've had to learn as well, and this is partly it's due to my temperament, which may or may not apply to you, but is that you don't have to have a big flaming thing going on with everybody all the time. It can be quite light and gentle. You can engage with people in quite a light and gentle way, okay? So you don't have to marry them. You can just engage with them in quite a light and gentle way. So I think the precept is really saying, respect the individuality of others and be loving towards other beings, and foster their self, their development, their positive development where you can. So I think if we've got a more solid metta practice, it can be more sustainable and it can be more respectful of others. So it doesn't involve a kind of rescuing dynamic or assuming responsibility for others based on what we think they need or what we think they should be doing. And I think rarely do we, I think for me it's quite a challenge knowing what I need to do, let alone what I think other people should do. So it's really, we're really kind of trying to respect their freedom and development. But I think also we can't work on everything at once. And I don't know about you, but sometimes when I used to come on retreat, I used to have these great, you know, explosions, excited explosions of thinking, oh, I need to do this and that and that, and have a list as long as my arm, probably two arms, about all the things that I needed to do and all the things I needed to work on. And if any, I could do my checklist, I'd be a perfect, enlightened being, and it would all be great by tomorrow morning. but we can't work on everything at once, okay? And I think that once we begin to know ourselves a bit more, it can feel a bit overwhelming. So I used to have these explosions of excitement about all the things I wanted to do and was planning to do, and then the kind of backlash of that, I felt completely overwhelmed, and I would tumble into sort of nihilism and despair, thinking, oh my goodness, can't possibly do all that. So it can feel a bit overwhelming. So again, I think the sort of watchword here is sustainability. Okay, sustainability in our practice. We can be our own, you know, sustainable ecosystem in that sense. Because I think that Bhante said that we just really don't understand the nature of change, how change really happens, I think deep change can take time, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. It does happen, but it can take time. And sometimes it's more effective to start working on small things first. So choosing something which looks reasonably small. Of course, sometimes the small things become bigger things, but hey, you know. But anyway, something that looks kind of manageable, you know. So looking at something that looks manageable and that looks kind of workable and possible. So, for example, if we wanted to become vegan, we might take a personal precept to try it for a month and build from there. And we might, for example, want to keep a little bit of a diary or some kind of practice that enables us to notice the effect of that change, whatever it may be, on our minds. So how does it affect our minds making this change? How does it affect how we are in the world with others? Or we might decide to turn towards somebody we find particularly difficult in our lives. Again, as in the advice of the Metta Bhavana, if it's somebody you've got an absolutely huge, huge difficulty with, chunk it down, go for somebody who's a little tricky, yeah, not hugely difficult. So again, sustainability. And I think little by little, supported by the other practices, like the Metta Bhavana, we can discover that our relationship to ourselves and other people and other beings is slowly transformed. And I think we can realise again and again that it was our stuff, our expectations and our unresolved wounds and our aversions and our stuff, all of our stuff, that was making the situation more difficult. That's not to say that we're not in an objectively difficult situation, it may well be, but in my experience I'm usually adding a whole chunk of stuff to the transaction as well. And we can only change ourselves. So although metta ultimately is impersonal, so we develop it initially in relation to other people and other beings. And I think Sangha, of course, is one of the three jewels. It offers us the opportunity here on retreat and out in the world to find liberation of the heart through metta. So we move away, perhaps, from this kind of idea of people to other people as being a concrete reality, yes, and who have aspirations, who want to love, who want to live, and who are like us. And of course, other people will behave in the way they behave, yeah? So they'll reject us, they'll love us, they'll misunderstand us, sometimes spectacularly, and much more. And it doesn't actually matter. So metta is this genuine concern for others, whether they reciprocate or not, okay? So looking around at our sangha and feeling disappointed or rejected is kind of to miss the point. So as Gandhi said, we need to be the change that we want to see in the world. So we start with us, okay? So I think in all of this, metta can be slow and it can be light, and being slow and light is fine, you know. I think it takes time to really see ourselves and our lives and see what needs changing, let alone how to change. And I think the Sangha is a great source of wisdom if we get a bit stuck and we don't know where we're going and we don't know what our next step is. The Sangha, in my experience, can really help us to find that path again. So I think in all of this, there's a need for virya, which is energy in pursuit of the good, as well as, I love these pairs, kshanti. So if you've not come across kshanti before, kshanti is patient forbearance. Okay, patient forbearance. As well as mindfulness, as Maitrasiddhi was talking about yesterday, and shraddha, that change, or shraddha, or faith, that change is possible in the spiritual life. So I think we also need to understand how sustainable change happens for us and ground it in self-metta. And as long as we keep practicing, progress is assured. Somebody said this to me years ago, and I was quite new to Triratna, and I thought, nah. I really didn't believe them, and I have to say I was completely wrong. I'm not talking about anything that might have happened to me here. I'm just talking about the change that I witness in my Sangha. Okay. So the spiritual life is alchemy. It is an extraordinary thing, and if you keep practicing, change happens. So I'm going to. I've got 8 minutes left. I'm going to close now, just by sort of saying that that we are metta. That is what we are. I think that is our nature. And so, in a sense, we're only really returning to what we are by practicing metta. And I'm going to close on a poem which some of you may know, and I just find almost unbearably moving, but I'll try and keep it together as I read it. And it's a poem called Kindness, again by Naomi Shihab Nye. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend.